And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and we have a special program today with two interviews. A little later, I'll be speaking with Tim Henderson, who's the director of Humanities Tennessee, about the organization and its 2017 Southern Festival of Books in Nashville. This October will be the 29th edition of one of the biggest book festivals in America. But up first, we have a special guest, a writer by the name of John Grisham. John Grisham is, of course, a best-selling author of legal thrillers and other popular novels who got his start writing stories set in the Mid-South. He has estimated sold over more than 300 million books worldwide, and I was invited by the website chapter16.org to interview him at his recent event at Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. Chapter16.org is the literary website of Humanities Tennessee, and they've graciously allowed us to use the audio from the interview on Book Talk. Mr. Grisham and I began our conversation about his latest novel, Camino Island, which is published by Doubleday. Now, of course, everyone wants to know, after 25 years, why have you hit the road again?
Got bored, tired of sitting around the house, and decided I needed to get out and go visit some bookstores and say thanks to booksellers and meet some fans and readers and say thanks to them.
Why had you stopped in the first place?
Got tired of it. It was back in the early 90s with the first big books. I went to a couple of national tours and did not enjoy those at all. Just business travel. It's always fun going to bookstores, but if you can't browse around and enjoy the experience, it's kind of hard to do that when you're signing books. I just got tired of it, and I also reached a point where I didn't have to do it. I don't know. Just looking back, it was a decision I made, and been wanting to get out though for a number of years.
But you had continued to support stores that supported you in the early days with signing books and letting them sell those.
There were five friends of mine who really helped out with A Time to Kill, and I went back to those stores probably up until 10 years ago. And we signed a lot of books in those stores. Those were very long autograph sessions, and they were fun.
Now, the book kicks off with a heist.
Yeah.
Have you heard from Princeton University and what they think about you burgling their library?
I keep waiting to hear from Princeton. To my knowledge, I've heard nothing. I don't know if Doubleday, my publisher, has heard anything. I don't know if my lawyers have heard anything. I hope they have a sense of humor. I think they probably do. And I put a nice disclaimer in the back of the book. No, I've yet to hear anything.
And why did you pick the Fitzgerald manuscripts?
Great question. I collect first editions, and I have a number of Faulkner's, Steinbeck's, Hemingway's, and Fitzgerald only had five manuscripts, tons of short stories. In fact, he was better known for his short stories when he was alive. Now, after his death, Gatsby became his big masterpiece and his most famous work. But Faulkner had 40 books, 40 manuscripts. They're all stored in one place at the library at the University of Virginia. I've seen them. They're very well taken care of, but there are 40 of them. It'd be kind of hard to steal, 40 of them. Hemingway's stuff is scattered, as is Steinbeck's. In fact, the library at UVA owns the first draft of The Grapes of Wrath. It was sold to the library by a descendant of John Steinbeck's. And so that left Fitzgerald. And as it so happened, and as I learned as I was doing the initial research, all five manuscripts are in one place at the Firestone Library at Princeton. So if you're going to steal, stuff that's truly priceless, that's a good place to start.
Now, one of our major characters is Bruce Cable, who owns a store on Camino Island, a bookstore. He deals in these first editions and sometimes some black market stuff as well. When you were describing his bookstore, Bay Books, it reminded me of Square Books down in Oxford, Mississippi.
I took Square Books, my favorite bookstore, my home bookstore, I took it and put it on Main Street in Santa Rosa on Camino Island.
And is that supposed to be like Amelia Island off the coast of
Florida? It is Amelia Island. The original title of the book was Amelia Island, and that's where we go to vacation. And we've been doing that for 25 years. And my wife and I, and even my kids, decided we go there for privacy, and so let's don't call attention to ourselves and to the island. So I changed the name at the last minute.
And they have a wonderful literary festival there themselves.
They do, and they have writers around. They have a bookstore. It's a very good atmosphere there.
Now, you have quite a big writer community. on Camino Island in the book, and I was just wondering how many of your friends or perhaps your enemies made it in some kind of disguised form.
The thing about Camino Island, Amelia Island, we go there to find privacy, and we really have yet to mix and mingle, and I have not met another writer there. We go to the bookstore there. It's a beautiful little store. We buy books there. Used to have two stores, now down to one. But we just don't get out and socialize down there. We go down there with our family to enjoy the beach, enjoy the house, to get away, hot weather, and read. You know, that's a vacation for us.
When I interview authors, it seems like there are weird coincidences that pop up. And I just interviewed Gail Godwin last week, and her book is The Grief Cottage, set on an island off the coast of South Carolina. But both of your books feature loggerhead turtles laying eggs as a prominent part.
I didn't know that. What's the title of it?
The Grief Cottage.
The Grief Cottage?
Yes.
Okay, I'll get a copy here today, Parnassus Books, and take it home with me.
She probably left some signed stock behind for you.
I like Gail's books.
Now, our other main character is Mercer Mann. She's a young novelist. She's in Chapel Hill, and she is facing a lot of student debt.
Yeah, she's got problems. Her life is not going the way she thought. She's 31 years old. She has a severe case of writer's block. She's been unable to write for probably 5 years. She is losing her job. She's broke, about to be homeless, and she's talented, but she can't find the right story. And that's the condition she's in when we meet her. And she's recruited by a sort of a sinister company to find the Fitzgerald manuscripts. They believe they know where they are, but they can't get they can't penetrate Bruce Cable's world on Camino Island. And they hire Mercer for a lot of money to go to Camino Island, a place she knows very well, and snoop around, infiltrate, spy. She doesn't want to do it, but she needs the money.
I'll have to say her handler from the corporation, Elaine, is probably the most fascinating character.
Really,
in the book.
She turned into a really fun character. And when my publisher first read the book back in January, the first draft, his first comment was, you know, he enjoyed the book and said nice things. He said, "Man, I would like to see a lot more of Elaine Shelby. She's a really good character." I said, "Well, it's too late for that."
I was thinking in my mind if Anne Bancroft were still with us, she would make a great Elaine.
Yeah.
Now, Bruce Cable washed out of Auburn University 20-some-odd years ago, and his rare book collection had kind of a shady start. Yeah,
you know, it tells you a lot about Bruce. He's always going to cut corners and make a buck. He, when he's 23 years old and still classified as a junior at Auburn, his father died suddenly. His mother is never mentioned in the story, so I don't want to deal with, you know, family issues. And so Bruce has a nice little inheritance that eventually pays for the bookstore he buys. But he went home to, when his father died, went home to Atlanta and discovered that his father had a collection of books. Upon closer observation, he realized some of those books were signed first editions of 20th century novelists. And he was stunned by it. He thought that they may have some value. He's an English major, not a very good one, but loves books, loves stories, loves writers. And so he actually broke the law by taking from his father's house before the funeral 18 first editions. And those books should have gone through his father's estate. Bruce didn't think so, and so he took them. And that was the foundation for his rare book collection, and it also really began his love of rare books. Bruce is a rogue. He's a playboy. He's also a very good bookseller and a reader and a very smart dealer of rare books.
And he took the idea very seriously, and he toured the country and went to a lot of bookstores, picked owner's brains, and, I mean, he was ready to go. He didn't go into it half-cocked.
No, he wanted to buy the bookstore. Once he saw the bookstore on Camino Island, he was intrigued with the notion of buying it, as a lot of people are. It's a romantic notion to own a bookstore. Very few people know how much hard work it is. And he had some money because of his inheritance, and he went off on this wonderful literary adventure that lasted, I think, 2 or 3 months. in search of independent bookstores. And he went all over the country, and he camped out in bookstores. He talked to owners. He went to signings. He met people. He met writers. He had a ball. And he had no itinerary, no schedule, didn't know where he was going. But after 2 months of that, he learned a lot about bookstores, and he knew what he wanted. And so he bought the store on Camino Island and renovated and opened for business.
Where did you get his hook of the seersucker suit being his signature?
I have no idea where that came from, but, you know, it's so hot down there year-round. I thought it would be fitting to have a dandy in the bookstore every day with a seersucker suit of a different shade. He probably owns 20 of them. In a starched white shirt with a bow tie and a pair of dirty Bucks with no socks, and that's his look. And the whole town, you know, knows that's Bruce Cable. His bookstore instantly became the hub of downtown Main Street, and the community is very proud of the bookstore. They support it big time.
Now Mercer is supposed to go down and see if she can gather any intel, possibly about the location of these Fitzgerald manuscripts. And for a novelist who is essentially a paid liar, she has a hard time lying in real life.
Mercer is a very nice person, and she's just not cut out for what they want her to do. She turns the job down. She says, I can't be deceitful. I can't do this. But at the same time, she needs the money. And when they offer to pay off her student loan, she says, okay, I'll do it. That plus the salary. And but she was conflicted the whole time. At the same time, she kind of fell in love with the place. And the other writers who lived there, and she and Bruce Cable were destined to have a fling, and they did.
And she had had a personal history with the island. Her grandmother lived down there, and she had lost her in a very tragic way, and that had kind of soured her on the place.
She hadn't been back in 11 years. She had a very unhappy childhood. Her parents split. Her mother was mentally ill. And she could not wait for the summer to go spend 3 months with Tessa, her grandmother, on Camino Island. And those are the happiest days of her life. And she says a couple times, you know, the happiest days of my life are behind me, which is tough for a 31-year-old to say. But that was her frame of mind when the novel opens.
Her father was a former Ford dealer in Memphis, Tennessee. His name was Herbert Mann. I was wondering if he was named after Herbie Mann, the jazz musician who made the album Memphis Underground.
Oh, come on. No way. I'm not that smart. I'm not that smart. No, he was not named after Herbie Mann.
So just today, as we're talking, your very first podcast from your book tour became available to the public. Why'd you decide to do a podcast, and how's it going so far?
Well, we thought if I'm going to go to a bookstore, wouldn't it be fun to have an event? I get tired of doing all the talking, so I said, okay, I'll invite some local writers wherever I go to come in. We'll talk about what they're writing, touring, their last book, their next book, whatever, publishing, the whole publishing scene, and take questions from the crowd, you know, make it an event. And we've done 8 of them. This will be number 9 tonight. And they've been very successful so far.
And it's going to be a limited run series just for the tour itself?
They're going to post one. They're going to drop one podcast per week for the next 13 weeks. Once they're dropped, once they're available, I think they stay there for a long time.
Right, but you're not going to do any past the 13.
I have no plans to go past 13 at this moment. If the podcast find an audience, I'm sure we'll discuss doing more signings/podcast. I'm not sure we can do any more with Camino Island because it's a summertime book. And if you start getting into September, the next novel comes out October 24th. That's a legal thriller. And so you don't want to get too close to that. What I'll probably do is tour some with the next legal thriller.
I'm not looking for competition, so I'm happy you're going to take a little break and give us some space. Of course, the new administration in the White House is big on people's minds. And with your work with the Innocence Project, it must be disconcerting to have someone like President Trump, who has publicly called for the execution of like the Central Park Five, even though they've been exonerated through DNA evidence.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much about this situation that's disturbing. We were beginning to make progress in the area of criminal justice reform. Both parties were sort of meeting in the middle. The Democrats won't reform because of the problems in the system. The Republicans won't reform because it's so expensive. Mass incarceration is terribly expensive. There's so many things we could fix if we would just do it. So we were having some bipartisan cooperation, and that's really under strain now because of the Attorney General has no real interest in that, and I don't know. It's very depressing.
Now, in Camino Island, there's a lot of talk about the monetary value of first editions.
Yeah.
But on this tour, you're helping raise money, and in your stop in Parnassus, you're talking more about the societal value of literature in helping raise money for Humanities Tennessee.
My wife and I have a little foundation, and we write all the checks ourselves, and we emphasize the humanities because that's what we believe in. We believe in the arts. We believe in the written word and performances, and that's very much a part of our lives.
Now, back in the book, later on, Bruce Cable has about 5 points for young authors, 5 rules for writing. Do you share your opinion of all those rules?
I made them up, and you know, I keep a list that I don't look at very often. People have asked me in the past, do you have any advice? And I'll say, I'll just email you my suggestions for writing popular fiction. At one point, there were 14 of them. Now I'm down to 8. I'll take one off. If I start breaking a rule, I'll take it off, take it off the list. And I'll think of something else. Yeah, Bruce kind of has his own list. Bruce reads, 4 books a week, I think. He's a big reader, and he reads, if a writer goes to his store, he's going to read the books. And so he is always hard at work with a book. But he has no patience with a book he doesn't like. And he has no patience for books that violate his rules. And so in the course of his conversation one night, over another long dinner, he starts telling Mercer, not giving advice, just saying, this is what I don't like. I don't like prologues. I don't like dialogue without quotation marks. I don't like big words that are artificial. I don't like, so he goes through the whole list.
And it was funny because he said the prologue, first chapter, second chapter, unrelated to each other, then they come together in the next chapter, and your book starts off first, second, and third chapters very distinct and separate from each other.
But there's no prologue. There's no prologue. No, that's a common mistake I see in popular fiction is just that, a prologue that's a gimmick to grab your attention, something dramatic, a child in danger or a stalker or something, that gets you hooked in and then takes off in another direction and then comes back to it by the time you've forgotten about it. So that's a pet peeve.
I shared the opinion of you should use quotation marks to set off dialogue. Do you think Cormac McCarthy should be the only person allowed to do that?
Yes, Cormac should be the only person allowed to do that. I think he started it. He has his own rules for grammar and writing, and he's Cormac. He can get by with it, but the rest of us cannot.
And quickly, what is the plot of the book coming up in October?
The background is the student debt crisis, and it all takes place in Washington, D.C., and it's some law students who are in a bad law school. It's a for-profit law school, and we have those in this country. And the story of how they borrow far too much money from the federal government, and it's all guaranteed by the taxpayers, and give this money to a for-profit law school that's owned by a hedge fund in New York. And they're third-year students. They're heavily in debt. They can't find jobs because their education is not that good, and they decide to check out and quit law school and get revenge.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us. It's really been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Nice job. Thank
you. John Grisham is the author of Camino Island, which is published by Doubleday. Up next is my brief conversation with Tim Henderson, director of Humanities Tennessee. They were the beneficiary of Mr. Grisham's fundraiser in Nashville, and I was able to speak to Tim at the recent launch party for the Southern Festival of Books. The festival will take place this coming October in Nashville. Since it was a raucous and well-attended party, the audio isn't as good as we normally have on Book Talk. our apologies. And a note of full disclosure, my interviews occasionally appear on chapter16.org, the literary website of Humanities Tennessee. So, Tim, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, when will this year's Southern Festival of Books be taking place?
This year's festival is going to be October the 13th, 14th, and 15th. That's always the second Friday through that Sunday of October. It is on the War Memorial Plaza, as it has been for some years. This year, we're anticipating some changes of venue slightly. We'll still have roughly the same footprint, but most of the sessions this year are going to be taking place in the downtown public library on Church Street. We will still have a good deal of the outdoor portion of the festival up on the War Memorial Plaza. Yes, across from the Capitol.
Will you still be using the War Memorial Auditorium?
We're planning to use the War Memorial Auditorium, yes. We are still waiting to finish programming the weekend, but our expectation is that we will have some sessions in the War Memorial Auditorium, yes.
And every year there's a kind of a special theme track. It's not the overall theme for the festival, but you concentrate on stuff like Veterans Affairs. A couple of years ago, what was this year's track?
That's right, yes. Every year for the past several years, we've been co-presenting with the Robert Penn Warren for the Center for the Humanities at Vanderbilt. A special track, usually this is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to a dozen sessions or so that take place over the course of the weekend. This year there's a particular focus on storytelling, more specifically various modes of storytelling. Not to get overly meta, but to think about how stories work, what the components of storytelling are, and then also what various media and genres and formats of storytelling present in terms of challenges and that sort of thing. So, for example, we plan to look at not only fiction and nonfiction writing as storytelling, but also graphic novels as storytelling, film as storytelling, music, etc. So really looking at lots of ways of telling sort of human stories.
Even podcasts.
Especially podcasts, yes. Thank you for reminding me. That's exactly right. Yes, there will be sessions talking about podcasts specifically as a way of telling stories.
Now, the festival is free for anyone to attend. It's pretty much first come, first serve for all the sessions, but it's not cheap, is it?
No, it is not. It costs everyone involved somewhere in the neighborhood of about $500,000 annually to put that festival on. But it's very important to us as an organization and also particularly with our mission of providing access to public programming that we do keep that program free and open to everyone over the course of the weekend. So, yes, it's, I'd say, far and away the most expensive program that we do as an organization, but we are really committed to keeping that open. So, as you might imagine and infer, we really rely on a lot of support from various places to put the festival on, especially our primary sponsor, which is the National Endowment for the Humanities, and they support everything that we do. But also other granting organizations, including the National Endowment for the Arts, the Metro National Arts Commission, the Tennessee Arts Commission, foundations, corporate sponsors, and then I would also say, especially importantly, individual donors are a very important part of what makes the festival happen, but also allows us to keep it free and open to everyone.
And there was a special fundraiser here at Parnassus Books just a few weeks ago with John Grisham, wasn't there?
I'm thrilled to say yes, there was. We were here, and it was a delightful evening. And we were really honored to be invited to be part of that by Parnassus Books. And Mr. Grisham showed up, had an evening of conversation with John Meacham and Ann Patchett. And we were, as I said, honored to be the recipients of the proceeds for that evening. So it was a huge fundraiser for Humanities Tennessee and particularly for the Southern Festival of Books.
Now, we do have stations all across the country. Could you recommend to people who may not be able to come to the Southern Festival of Books how they can support their own local humanities organizations?
Yes, I would say first, the first and foremost, what you need to do if you aren't familiar with your Humanities Council where you are, get online and look them up and see where they are. All of the states and territories in the United States, as well as the District of Columbia, have state and territorial humanities councils that are affiliates of the NEH. They all rely on individual support, as well as grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. So, yes, look those organizations up. Find out where they are online and then participate in their programming. They all do really amazing things, and there's a good deal of autonomy among the state councils. So the programming is really varied among them. So what we do is really tailored to the folks who live in Tennessee, but that's true of the councils all over the nation. So I would encourage everyone, find out where your council is, see what they're doing, and especially see what they're doing in your neck of the woods and in your part of the state. Participate in those programs and make a contribution to support the work of those councils.
And while you mentioned the Southern Festival, it's maybe the most high-profile activity Humanities Tennessee has of the year. What are some of the other events and workshops they have going on?
Well, we do a number of other particularly language and literature-based programs, including two week-long residential writing workshops for high school students. One of those starts tomorrow as we speak. So those take place. One is the Appalachian Young Writers Workshop that takes place in Harrogate in Upper East Tennessee, and the one that's beginning tomorrow is the our original workshop, which is the Tennessee Young Writers Workshop that takes place at Cumberland University on Lebanon, but in Lebanon, Tennessee, where we've been really fortunate to find great partners in universities around the state to help us host those workshops, but also have really great faculty, all published authors who are great teachers and work very closely. It's a very small teacher-to-student ratio in those classrooms, so students get a lot of hands-on instruction from the faculty. It is a residential workshop, so by the end of that week, you know, the students have really immersed themselves in not only the process of writing, but being a part of a community of writers. So they find themselves with like-minded students of a similar age from all over the state, and really building a community of writers over the course of that week. Many of them return, and it's been a really successful program. So that's another example of language and literature programs. I should also point out chapter16.org, which is our online literary publication that updates with new content every day of the week. Stephen, you have some pieces on there as well.
Full disclosure.
Yes, full disclosure, and we're really fortunate to have you be a part of that that project as well. But we also do, apart from language and literature programs, we also do history and culture programs around the state and work with a variety of other humanities organizations, small, local, or regional historical museums, historical societies, and in some of our programs, just any other sort of nonprofit who wants to engage their audiences by providing accessible public humanities programming, and we help them bring those to people all over in communities all over the state.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and we're really looking forward to the festival.
So am I. Thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a pleasure.
Tim Henderson is the executive director of Humanities Tennessee, and their Southern Festival of Books will take place October 13th, 14th, and 15th on War Memorial Plaza in downtown Nashville, Tennessee. More information about the Southern Festival of Books in Humanities Tennessee is available at humanitiestennessee.org. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced by Stephen Usry and is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Number one, you must attribute the work to WYPL Radio of Memphis, Tennessee. Number two, you may not use this work for commercial purposes. And number three, no derivative works are allowed. You may not transform, alter, or build upon this work. For any reuse or distribution of this work, you must make clear to others the license terms of the work. Any of the previous conditions can be waived if you get permission from WYPL Radio. And nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.